translation and purport by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami, Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. The Lord, whose activities are always spotless, is the master of the six senses and is fully omnipotent with six opulences. He creates the manifested universes, maintains them, and annihilates them without being in the least affected. He is within every living being and is always independent. Purpose. The prime difference between the Lord and the living entities is that the Lord is the creator and the living entities are the created. Here, he is called the Amogha Lila, which indicates that there is nothing lamentable in his creation. Very interesting statement. There is nothing lamentable in his creation. We can see that sometimes devotees have tendency to lament also, right? Either about themselves or about others or about state of the world. But interesting, Srila Prabhupada says, there is nothing lamentable in the Lord's creation. Those who create disturbance in his creation are themselves disturbed. So why should we be disturbed about those who are disturbed and create disturbances? He is transcendental to all material afflictions because he is full with all six opulences, namely wealth, power, fame, beauty, knowledge, and renunciation. And thus he is the master of the senses. So Prabhupada quotes the statement, Vedic statement, which lists the six opulences of the Lord: Aishvaryasya, Samagrasya, Viryasya, Yashashashya, Jnana, Vairagya. So quite often this point is brought up. He creates these manifested universes in order to reclaim the living beings who are within them, suffering threefold miseries, maintaining them, and in due course annihilates them without being the least affected by such actions. He is connected with this material creation very superficially, as one smells odor without being connected with the odorous article. Non-godly elements, therefore, can never approach him despite all endeavors. Savaidam Vishvam Amogalila Srijatabhatina Sajatesmin Bhuteshu Chantarhita Atma Tantra Sadvargikam Jigratisat Gunesha. The Lord, whose activities are always spotless, is the master of the six senses and is fully omnipotent with six opulences. He creates the manifested universes, maintains them, and annihilates them without being in the least affected. He is within every living being and is always independent. So, in here, after discussing in the beginning of the chapter so many different incarnations of the Lord, Sutta Goswami also explains the Lord's position and his purposes behind his activities. And so the Lord is the prime creator, maintainer, and annihilator within this material world, even though he does empower so many different beings to represent him in that regard. Everybody is just an instrument in the hands of the Lord, Ekaleshwara Krishna Rasava Britya. He is the only Lord, everybody else is the master. And Chaitanya Charitamrita explains, everybody is dancing in accordance with the way Lord makes everyone dance. And the Lord is endowed with six opulences, which he shares with living entities. because living entities are his children, and naturally, as loving father, he wants to facilitate his children in fulfilling their desires. Unfortunately, the desires of those who came to this material world was to forget him and enjoy independently. And the Lord, out of his love, facilitates that desire by creating this material world. And so Srila Prabhupada is explaining that the material creation has dual purpose. One is to allow living entities to fulfill their desires, oftentimes perverted desires for sense gratification. This is what's happening in this world, to the most case. And second purpose is to facilitate their going back home, back to Godhead. And actually, these two things are interconnected also. So Prabhupada oftentimes was talking about dogs, and mostly in a critical way. But sometimes he would also speak about, not about dogs, but dogs are just one species of life created by the Lord, but about attachment of human beings to the dogs. He was speaking in a critical way, but once he spoke about that attachment in a very positive way. He said, why people take so much care of dogs, and why do they, you know, walk them out, etc., etc.? Because they love their dogs. And he said, in the same way, Lord loves all living entities because he's their master and protector. And even though the conditioned living entities might be doing complete nonsense, like dog while out on the walk, what's the dog's business? So Prabhupada explains, just run around for what purposes? Mostly, we know very well, to pass urine. Especially dogs are very fond of passing little bit of urine on everything to mark the territory. Pass urine and stool. That's the dog's business. Run around and pass urine and stool. And so he said, what's the business of the, what is the very important business the living entities are engaged in this material world? They just run around and pass urine and stool. Little bit here, little bit there, little bit everywhere. Really, really important business, right? But if you look at the dogs, they think they're doing really important business. So in the same way, in the material world, everybody thinks that they're really engaged in important business. Of course, this business is not important for the master, but the master is just patiently waiting for the dog to become satisfied and take the dog home. And so Srila Prabhupada says, in the same way, the Lord is accompanying every living entity who is running around the material world, just patiently waiting. When this living entity finally become satisfied with doing the business in the material world, to take the living entity back home, back to Godhead. And so this is the Lord's desire. And actually he gives his opulences to the living entities so that they would fulfill all their desires and finally realize that it doesn't make them happy. So in that sense, we can understand very interesting point, which is rather unique to our Vaishnava philosophy, that the greatest fortune for someone who is on the spiritual path is to realize that there is no happiness in the material world by actually getting everything one wants materially. And then renouncing this world with full conviction that there is no happiness here and fully dedicating oneself to Krishna's service. And if you observe carefully, for example, in the lives of the devotees, many times, I think most of the times, it actually does happen. Because Bhaktivinoda Thakur describes the holy name as Harinama Chintamani, the wish-fulfilling touchstone of the holy name, which fulfills any desires. And so devotees who start the process of devotional service, they have all kinds of desires. And then actually these desires are getting realized in the process of devotional service, in the process of chanting the holy names. But interestingly enough, because devotees also develop taste for Krishna consciousness, which diminishes the material hankering and lamentation, the fulfillment of those desires, material desires, just helps them to realize that this is what I actually don't want, that this hankering was illusory. And then they become more and more convinced about the value of spiritual life. Anyone has this experience, that in the process of Krishna consciousness, your material desires are getting fulfilled, but you lose taste for them? Okay. So it's very typical, I found. So this is the system. This is how the material world is meant for both purposes, to fulfill the desires and help us to advance spiritually and ultimately go back home, back to Godhead. And, of course, the devotees who are serious and interested in facilitating Krishna's desires, they all also think, how do we help everyone around us to advance spiritually? How do we help as many living entities as we can to go back home, back to Godhead, go to Krishna? And I know it's very typical for ISKCON devotees to have the desire to somehow facilitate others in their spiritual journey, help others to advance spiritually, both devotees and members of the public. So let's see how many of you have this desire to help others. Okay, few. I'm sure more, but some are not raising their hands, being a little shy. And of course, what to speak of us, so many senior leaders in our movement are very intensely meditating on how do we make it possible, how do we do that. And not only how do we ourselves become successful in our spiritual development, as well as facilitating others in their spiritual development, but how do we facilitate those who can potentially facilitate others in their spiritual development, and maybe even one level higher? How do we facilitate those who can facilitate those who can facilitate those who can help others in their spiritual development? And actually, if you look very carefully at the social structure which is described, especially in the first canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, very clearly, that devotees are meant for that, to be on the very top of the pyramid of the society, facilitating everybody in their spiritual development. And because brahmanas are teachers of the whole society, and Vaishnavas are the best of the brahmanas, right? So this is what Srila Prabhupada's intention was in creating our society, ISKCON, and we know it very well. And therefore, there are so many devotees who are thinking, how do we facilitate that? And it's very interesting, the mention of the six opulences in this verse. A statement which comes to my mind is in regards to wealth, for example, right? Because wealth is one of the opulences, obvious opulence. If someone has tons of money, then obviously he is considered to be opulent man or woman, whichever case might be. And 12th canto of Srimad Bhagavatam is mentioning that the saintliness of a person in Kali Yuga will be judged by how much money one has. So the more money one has, the more saintly the personality is. So that's because people are judging by external factors, which, I mean, in one sense, it has connection to the absolute truth, of course, even though it's funny that every wealthy man is a saint. That's, of course, a little bit wrong in interpretation. But if we understand that, why do people become wealthy? Why people become famous? Why they gain powerful positions? Why they become beautiful? Why some people are really, really smart, etc. And some people are more detached than other people. So what's the reason why it's all happening to some, but not everybody? Why some people are endowed with one or more of those opulences, whereas so many aren't? And answer is very clear, that because this is also Lord's mercy. Because these people have done something in their past lives, or maybe even in this life, to get the favor of the Lord. And why the Lord is bestowing this favor upon them? To help them to continue serving Him directly or indirectly and facilitating others. Unfortunately, some people, they abuse the mercy of the Lord, right? But not everybody. Many people do use their intelligence, their wealth, their position, and other opulences in the service of the Lord. And actually, of course, the prime example for us is Srila Prabhupada, because he was blessed with everything. We can understand. Not immediately, he had to perform austerities, but, you know, Krishna bestowed so much wealth on him that even CNN listed him as one of the top 10 achievers in the 20th century in the category of those who, in the category of late starters, right? In terms of, you know, money, monetary gain. And so, Prabhupada's fame and, of course, his knowledge and renunciation. So, This is what's attracting people. So Prabhupada said, I could be easily sitting under some tree and preach Krishna consciousness, but how many people would be impressed and how many people would come? But we have an opulent facility, such as Bhaktivedanta Manor and other opulent facilities Srila Prabhupada created all over the world. And then you have Prime Minister of the whole country coming. Prime Minister would not be coming under the tree. It's very unlikely, right? But Prime Minister would be coming to the laying the cornerstone for Haveli. So we can understand that this is the system. This is the system the Lord introduced, and this is the system Srila Prabhupada introduced. That use the opulence of the Lord for serving the Lord and encouraging everyone in the Lord's service. And when the time will come, people will naturally become detached from that because that material world doesn't have much to offer, and satiation is coming very quickly to those who are on the path of spiritual advancement. And so, therefore, many senior leaders in our society are thinking, how do we make Prabhupada's desire into a reality? And what was Prabhupada's desire is very clear. From the very first purpose of ISKCON, he introduced, right, to systematically propagate spiritual knowledge to society at large and teach all people in the technicals of spiritual life in order to check the imbalance of values in life, which is very sophisticated way of saying helping people to solve their problems, help the society to solve their problems, and achieve real unity and peace in the world. So real unity and peace in the world, and some devotees are scratching their heads. Sometimes we don't have enough unity amongst ourselves, and sometimes our own devotees are not peaceful enough. So how do we achieve real unity and peace in the world? So it's a daunting task that we, even though it's much better now than, say, a few decades ago when Prabhupada started. What Prabhupada had to deal with. One time I inquired from one of our leaders, from our gurus, that why it's happening sometimes that mentally disturbed people become attracted to Krishna consciousness. And of course they come and they create disturbance among the devotees, and devotees don't know how to deal with them. Okay, Krishna attracted this soul, but you know, the mind of this soul is so complicated. You know, it's pretty hard. You have to be a psychiatrist to know how to deal with these kind of cases. So, and when the spiritual master heard my question, he laughed so much. He said, you're only asking these kind of questions because you haven't joined the movement in Prabhupada times. If you would join the movement back then, you would be posing the question in a different way. You would be asking, how come that sometimes normal people join this movement? So just an illustration of what Prabhupada had to deal with in the early days. And so he did all the, you know, hard work for us. And now, you know, he made it so easy. But still, we have some, comparing to what it was, minor challenges. And we might think, oh, so how do we fulfill Prabhupada's desire, realize Prabhupada's vision, which was for the movement to unite the whole world on spiritual basis and create peace and harmony and, of course, happiness and love and everything. So how that would happen? Jai Shri Shri Radha Gokulananda Shri Shri Sitaram Lakshman Hanuman Shri Gaur Nitai Ki Jai. Even Radha Gokulananda are wondering how that would happen. And actually, I've been discussing this with many senior leaders, and we found a lot of common ground. And I've been fortunate enough to try and facilitate some of the efforts in that regard through the Leadership Empowerment School in Mayapur, which we've successfully completed the first semester this year, and we have some alumni, quite impressive results, with quite impressive results in just under 3 months' time. And one of the senior Vaishnavas I was discussing this point with, and who is also very much interested in that, His Holiness Kavi Chandra Maharaj, he shared an article with me coming from one Christian preacher and leader, and I found it very interesting, and I've read it to few devotees. They found it also very interesting. Of course, it's written from Christian perspective, and not everything might be relevant for us, at least not to 100% extent, but there are many, many valid points, and I'm sure many of you will find many parallels with our situation and our challenges. And so the solutions he is offering. It will take only 5 or 6 minutes. Would you like to hear? Yeah? Okay. So the article is called 12 Signs That You Are a Spiritual Entrepreneur. So you're building your team, you're even assessing your personal gifting for everything that lies ahead in ministry. What's the gift set you're looking for that in a leader or in yourself that will really help move your mission forward, reach new people, and prepare for everything ahead? At some point, at the senior leadership level of your church movement, you are going to need a handful of what I call spiritual entrepreneurs. Often these people are misunderstood in the church. Of course, we don't have a church, but Srila Prabhupada was using the term churchianity, which I believe he took from Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati, and he was quite critical of the phenomena of churchianity, which is opposed to a living and vibrant spiritual movement. So we can understand this in this particular context. For the most part, shepherds and chaplains have run the church. I'm not saying that we don't need shepherds and that we don't need chaplains in the right place. Not at all. We do. But what happens when all you have are shepherds and chaplains? Here what happens. The kind of radical change that both the church and the world need doesn't happen. Instead, leaders hold the hand of a sick church and comfort it while it dies. I know that sounds harsh, but look around you. Isn't that mostly what's happening? I also know enough good shepherds and chaplains to know that they find the hand holding of a dying church deeply frustrating and frightening. They don't want their church to die, but there aren't enough leaders around them with the gift set of or mindset necessary to turn it around. Something's missing. The missing gift set in the church is spiritual entrepreneurship. something the New Testament calls apostleship. It's the kind of radical determination, innovation, and fierceness the Apostle Paul showed. As I wrote about here, the church today is filled with shepherds, to the point where shepherds are perhaps overrepresented in church leadership. What we need most as we navigate new waters in a post-Christian culture is not more shepherds, but spiritual entrepreneurs. Whether you call it spiritual entrepreneurship or the gift of apostleship, what we need is a new generation of Apostle Pauls who forge out in new directions. And for us, of course, we need new generations of those who follow in Prabhupada's footsteps, because he is the undisputed model for all of us. Who experiment boldly, who dare greatly. Spiritual entrepreneurs are the kind of leaders who will find tomorrow's solutions when most leaders can only see the problems. In a marketplace that's in love with startups and new ventures, we need some leaders who are inclined to spend their lives in the marketplace, who will take their God-given talents and energy and throw them full-time behind the mission of the church. Are you called to it? As I write about here, the fact that you have the gifts might be enough of a sign that you are called. So what does spiritual entrepreneurship look like? What are the characteristics of leaders who can forge fresh ground in the church? And how do you know if you might be a spiritual entrepreneur? As I meet church leaders who are actually reaching unchurched people in massive quantities, here are the qualities I see among the leaders. I wrote about five characteristics I see in their churches. Spiritual entrepreneurs. 1. Think big. Too many churches die of small thinking. What is this small thinking? We don't have enough. It won't happen. Stop dreaming. That's plenty for now. Who will pay for it? Leaders who serve an infinite God should never have their imaginations deadened by small thinking. Spiritual entrepreneurs aren't. They think big. They dream of what could be, not what is, and they see the opportunity in every obstacle. 2. Believe God can. We serve a God who created amazing things out of nothing. Why do we think he won't do the same for his church? Spiritual entrepreneurs believe he will, and they see him do it. They would agree with Henry Ford, who said, "Whether you believe you can or whether you believe you can't, you are right." Before you dismiss this as positive thinking nonsense, remember, Jesus couldn't perform many miracles in his hometown because of people's lack of faith. Then, moments later, he walked on water and fed 5,000 because people in those communities had faith. Spiritual entrepreneurs believe God can, and they see him do it. 3. See abundance, not scarcity. Spiritual entrepreneurs see abundance, not scarcity. Give a dying church £10,000, and they will think they are broke and need to conserve it. Give 10,000 to a spiritual entrepreneur, and he'll see it as seed money to start something big. To a dying church, 5 leaders is defeat. To a spiritual entrepreneur, it's a start. Same facts, different mindset. Attitude is everything. 4. Think vision first, resources second. So what comes first, vision or resources? Spiritual entrepreneurs are very comfortable with the reality that vision precedes resources. Casting a big vision, a solid on-mission vision, will often lead to significant resources down the road. Waiting for big resources so you can have a vision is a recipe for death. 5. Invest in personal and team development. Spiritual entrepreneurs aren't crazy spenders, but they see a key distinction between an expense and an investment. They realize that going to conferences, networking with other leaders, buying books, and doing whatever it takes to make themselves And their team better is an investment. Sure, there are limits, but smart spiritual entrepreneurs will often spend a minimum of 10% of all the money they receive making themselves and their team better. 6. Believe this is bigger than them. Of all the criticisms levied at spiritual entrepreneurs, the most common is often that they have big egos and that's all about them. Sometimes that's true, but most often it's not. Big vision does not automatically equal big ego. The best spiritual entrepreneurs humbly submit to God and are committed to a vision that is so much bigger than they are. Personal humility combined with big ambition for the mission fosters incredible leadership. Think about it this way. The reason we are talking about Paul 2,000 years later is that Paul's work wasn't about Paul. It was about Jesus and the mission of the church. If your vision is all about you, it will die with you. True spiritual entrepreneurs know that. 7. Ship first, improve later. Perfectionists make terrible entrepreneurs. If you haven't shipped on your vision yet because you are waiting for ideal conditions or the perfect result, you'll wait forever. People email me all the time, usually often going to a conference hosted by a large church with lots of resources, and ask whether a new building or better lighting or a move to a portable location will help them grow. I always tell them it won't. Big churches never started big. They usually started very humbly. But because they are led by spiritual entrepreneurs, those entrepreneurs at every stage made the most of whatever they had. A spiritual entrepreneur can launch a growing church in a dying building with little money. Then they make all the improvements later as facilities and resources grow. 8. Are fine with ambiguity. Ask a spiritual entrepreneur how they are going to do it, and the number one answer is, I don't know, we're just going to do it. There is something powerful in that. If you have it all figured out before you launch it, your vision isn't big enough. 9. Will risk it all without guarantee of success. Too many leaders hope for some kind of guarantee. Risk brings no guarantees because it's risk. Spiritual entrepreneurs are okay with that. Most spiritual entrepreneurs want to die trying. Immediately, we can understand this was Prabhupada, right? But the fact that they are willing to is crucial. Ironically, if a spiritual entrepreneur has a solid plan that's on mission, they usually don't fail. But you have to be willing to fail to succeed. 10. Never wait for consensus. That's an interesting one. Too many churches will only move forward if there is consensus. That's a critical mistake. Consensus kills courage. By the time you have consensus, ideas are so watered down they are worthy of the committee that put them together. Spiritual entrepreneurs rarely act alone, at least the small ones don't, but they are ready to move ahead with a group of early adopters, knowing most will eventually buy into whatever is being proposed once they see it working. 11. Let the critics talk why they act. The critics will always talk. Spiritual entrepreneurs know this. They don't get weighed down by critics who criticize what others do and do little themselves. How do you respond to the critics? By acting. Just act while the critics talk. You will accomplish something they won't. Number 12, break rules. Quite obviously, you should never break biblical rules or scriptural rules. And the great spiritual entrepreneurs never do. Their character is solid. But you are going to absolutely need to break some human rules if you are going to disrupt the status quo. Innovation always breaks rules. Why? Because innovation never asks for permission. It just innovates. And so, I'm sure all of you recognized that how all the 12 points are so obviously connected to Srila Prabhupada. And Prabhupada had a desire and he made number of statements that devotees should become just like him. And when devotees were saying how this is possible, Srila Prabhupada, he was saying, not only it is possible, but this is my order. You have to become like me. And so we thought it's a very interesting analysis, the 12 points program, what you would have to do to become like Prabhupada. So thank you all very much. Unfortunately, we don't have time for questions or comments, but I'm sure that some devotees would want to discuss this further. And I'll be very happy to do that individually. Hare Krishna. Grandharaj Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai, Srila Prabhupada ki jai, Nitai Gaur Premanande.